Committee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare.
Well,
order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2953. Well, let's see. We have some other folks here today, too. Let's close the public hearing for a moment on 2953 and I'll reopen the public hearing. I got it right. I thought it was something else. On 2953, and I'll Representative Carolyn Tomei to speak.
For the record, my name is Carolyn Tomei. I'm the representative from House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for allowing me to come today to speak to this committee. I'm presenting House Bill 2953, which requires health insurance plans to cover bone density measurements at regular intervals. Bone density screening is a highly effective tool to identify those individuals at risk for osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is a major public health threat for an estimated 44 million Americans. It is a major cause of bone fractures in postmenopausal women and in older persons in general. There is an amazing statistic which I will read to you and which you have in my materials. One in two women and one in four men over the age of 50 will have an osteoporosis-related fracture in her or his remaining lifetime. That is just an astounding statistic. The estimated national direct care expenditures, including hospitals, nursing homes, and outpatient services for osteoporosis fractures, was $18 billion a year in 2002, and it's still growing. As the baby boomers age, As baby boomers age, it is estimated that the direct medical costs of osteoporosis will increase 20-fold by the year 2040. With regular bone density screening, medical personnel can identify those individuals who are most at risk of fractures and actively losing bone mass. Early detection and treatment can help prevent debilitating falls and fractures. That treatment may include a diet rich in calcium and vitamin D, increased physical activity with emphasis on balance and weight-bearing exercise, and in some cases, drug therapy. House Bill 2953 specifies that these screenings should begin at menopause for women when lower estrogen levels increase the risk of bone loss, for men at age 75, as bone thinning might occur due to the natural aging process. The bill applies to group health insurance plans, and it also applies to the individual market. There will be doctors here. I hope Dr. Orwell from OHS.
He's right behind you.
That's wonderful. Thank you for coming. I also have an article. You don't have it there, but I can get copies of it if you want. From several weeks ago in the Oregonian, there's a Living Wellness, and it tells the different exercise programs that folks have. And there is a lovely-looking woman who is 65, 5 feet, 10 and a half inches tall, who has a regular program of exercise. And she found out 5.5 years ago, so I think she would have been about 57, that she was diagnosed with osteoporosis. And this was a woman who was very active, had great health, had great diet, exercised frequently, and still she had osteoporosis and had no idea of that. And as we know, which has happened with my mother-in-law, and imagine you know elderly people too, who have fallen and broken bones and never recover. They often, you know, after they break a bone, they've been healthy, living by themselves, and they go into a nursing facility and very often never leave because it's so hard to recover. And many of these people don't realize that they have osteoporosis. And there also will probably be an amendment on the bill on the first page, lines 14 through 16. So suggesting that the tests be done every 2 years for women who are at menopause and have known or have known risk factors, and every 2 years for men who are 75 years or age. And I think we'll be looking at an amendment. I think we may find that that is too often.
Okay.
But I'll have you listen to Dr. Orla unless you have questions for me.
Are there questions, Representative Tomei?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Tomei, I do have one question, if you may. And I'll, other people may be the right one to ask. In your explorations on this bill, did you find out the extent to which health insurance companies do cover bone density screening now?
I think Dr. Orwell can answer you better than I. My understanding is that they will cover it if you ask for it, but they don't offer it. And we're hoping that by making it a mandatory part of a health insurance plan, that doctors will offer it to patients, women going through menopause and many men age 75 or older.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to call Dr. Eric Orwell, my old friend, and I'm also one of his subjects in the study on osteoporosis in men. So.
Hello, Mitch.
Very happy to be
here. Glad to see
Hi,
you
Eric.
In this setting.
Can you introduce yourself for us?
Yeah, I'm Eric Orwell. I'm a physician and endocrinologist, or endocrinologist and physician. I'm the director of the Bone and Mineral Unit at the university, professor of medicine there. I'm the associate vice president for research at the university, associate dean for the School of Medicine, and the director of the Clinical and Translational Research Institute. My professional life has been spent thinking about metabolic bone disease and osteoporosis, doing research to understand the causes and outcomes of osteoporosis, and research looking at appropriate diagnostic and therapeutic approaches to osteoporosis. So this is what I live and breathe, basically. And I feel passionate about this issue. So let me launch into why I feel that passion. The representative has already told you about the impact of osteoporosis. It's huge. So those of you in the subcommittee who are women face a 50% chance of having an osteoporotic fracture. And those of you who are men, a 25% chance of having an osteoporotic fracture in your lifetime. Once you have your first osteoporotic fracture, you face another 50% chance of having a second osteoporotic fracture. So a lot of us are going to have osteoporotic fractures during our lifetime unless something changes. So I'm not going to go through the things that she's gone through before about the impact of the disease. It's simply enormous. There are a couple of key questions that I think you should consider, though, in thinking about this bill. And the first, as I address in the second part of, or second page of my handout, is can people at risk of fracture be identified? In other words, can we find those people who are going to have a fracture so that we can do something about it? And the answer is clearly yes. We can't identify everybody that's going to have a fracture, but bone mineral density testing, the kind that we're talking about, is very predictive of people who are at risk. It's more predictive than cholesterol in the prediction of heart attack, or blood pressure in the prediction of stroke. Mitch, the hazard ratio of one standard deviation reduction in bone mineral density for fracture is 3 to 4. So it really enriches your ability to identify people who are going to have a fracture. Secondly, bone mineral density testing is safe and easy, so uses radiation, but the amount of radiation that you would experience living in Denver for a week or having a cross-country plane trip, it's simply negligible. Having a bone density test is easy for even elderly and infirm people. You get on a table, a machine scans back and forth, and there's no invasive aspects to this whatsoever. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes. And finally, and very importantly, the costs of bone density testing are relatively low. So currently, Medicare reimburses for outpatient bone density testing at an amount of $85, approximately $85, which is really low compared to lots of other medical procedures. So bone density testing is easy, safe, effective, and not very expensive. And it represents a a major way that we have in identifying people who are going to have fractures. By identifying those people, we can do something about their fracture risk. So the second part of this is that effective prevention is available. So if you have a bone density test and your bone density is low, not critically low, not osteoporotic, but low, there are interventions that are also cheap and easy and safe that can prevent your bone density from getting lower and reduce your risk of fracture. Things like calcium and vitamin D, exercise, estrogen replacement therapy in postmenopausal women, if that's appropriate for that particular woman, etc. So prevention can happen as a result of a bone density test. There is an action item that is effective as a result of a low bone density measurement. Effective treatment for osteoporosis is available. We couldn't say that 5 or 10 years ago, so it didn't matter whether you had a diagnostic test. Now having a diagnostic test means that if you have osteoporosis, effective therapy is available. So there are drugs that have been on the market for 10 years or more that are known to be safe and that reduce the risk of fracture by 50%+. So that means having a bone density test, really, and having osteoporosis means that you can do something about your risk of fracture. So the implications of the test are important and lead to useful therapies. Also important, as I list here, is that measuring bone mineral density is cost-effective. In other words, a variety of very capable groups have gone through the exercise of looking at whether it's cost-effective for society to pay for bone density testing, assuming that the test yields important information, that information yields therapy, therapy costs something, but the reduction in fractures and the reduction in disability, et cetera, saves all that money in the end. So those calculations have led to, for instance, the Preventative Services Task Force, which is part of the Public Health Service, to flat out recommend that all women over the age of 65 should have a bone density test. The recommendations about earlier postmenopausal women and men are not as well developed, but as I list here, most of the medical societies that deal with this issue clearly recommend that premenopausal women with any risk factor, for instance, a positive family history of fracture or low body weight or a variety of medications or medical conditions, should have a bone density test, as should men with any risk factors for having a fracture. So these are ubiquitous recommendations and quite well founded. Very importantly, Medicare and insurance companies currently reimburse for these indications. So they currently reimburse if you're a 65-year-old woman for you to have a bone density test. If you're an earlier postmenopausal woman with a risk factor, insurance companies reimburse for these tests. And if you're a man with a risk factor for a bone density, for fractures, insurance will reimburse for these tests. So these recommendations are not, at least these screening recommendations, are not suggesting anything that insurance does not already reimburse for. Next important point is that despite the recommendations and the effectiveness of bone density testing and its cost effectiveness, these things don't get done. So if you're a 65-plus-year-old woman and go to your physician, the likelihood is that that physician is and you are concerned with a whole variety of issues, and bone density testing just doesn't percolate to the top very often. So it's been repeatedly demonstrated that 20% or less of people that should have bone density tests actually get them. And this is a major reason that fractures continue to be a problem. People who need the test don't get it, and people who need treatment don't get it. And a lot of this is because this is never instigated in the first place, which is the heart and soul of this bill. We want to put some opportunity for the patient, him or herself, to take some responsibility for getting the test done and not leave it only to the responsibility of the physician. So, again, this is a safe, easy, cost-effective test that makes a difference for the health of Oregonians and U.S. citizens in general. There's a blockade in getting it used and getting effective therapy for osteoporosis underway, and that block is that it simply isn't ordered when everybody recognizes that it should be by clinicians who are faced with busy clinical practices and lots of other things on their mind. This was similar thing was recognized for mammography some time ago, and as you know, the federal legislation now allows women to instigate a mammogram by herself. Doesn't need a physician order to get a mammogram, and we want the same thing to be true of bone density testing. The one controversial part of this bill that the representative referred to is the repeat measurements. How often should a person have a repeat bone density measurement after the first one? Presumably, if the first bone density test shows osteoporosis and therapy is appropriate, it'll be undertaken. And then repeat bone density measurements, everybody agrees, and insurance and Medicare reimburse, should be done again to follow up on that treatment to make sure it's effective. If you have a bone, this is the controversial part. If you have a bone density test, and it shows your bone density is okay or modestly low, but everybody recognizes that at some point down the road, bone loss can occur, and you might eventually end up being osteoporotic. How often should you have a bone density test to see if bone density is being lost and something should be done to intervene? That's unclear. When the bill was written at every 2 years, we thought that that would be a reasonable interval to get bone density testing in people who are concerned about bone loss. But, again, that's the most unclear part of this bill, and I think there could be some flexibility in that recommendation. The other parts of it, though, I feel very passionately about. A 65-plus-year-old woman should be able to instigate these tests and take some control of her own health. A earlier premenopausal woman with risk factors for osteoporosis, or a man with risk factors for osteoporosis, or who is elderly, should be able to have some control over this part of his or her health. So, that's the important information I wanted to impart. Be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Good question. Question? Yes, Representative Richardson.
Just to make sure that I understand what's going on, we have a bill that requires that there be coverage for bone mass measurement, yet that coverage currently exists, and that if women were to ask for it, they could receive it. I can't imagine doctors saying, I'm sorry, no, we're not going to let you have this. But we're going to pass a law that mandates that that coverage be there in the hope that it will cause women to ask for it themselves because their doctors aren't asking for it, and yet the doctors are the trained clinicians. That's basically what we're doing.
So the reality, I think, I mean, there's a lot of truth to what you've just said, but there are some shadings to it. If you go to the physician, this is the reality. If you go to your physician, you know you've got 15 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever it is. Commonly, not only does the physician not bring it up, but the patient doesn't remember to bring it up or doesn't know enough to bring it up. It may come up a month later or 2 months later or something, and most people are not going to call their doc and go in for a special appointment, pay for it, to ask for a bone density test. There is clearly a blockade there in terms of getting these tests done when they should, and all the research points to it. The second part of this is that currently a woman cannot get a bone density test without a physician's order, because the test is simply set up that way. In other words, you can't just walk in and ask for a bone density test without the physician actually writing the order.
I understand exactly.
Will this bill change that?
Yes, this bill will allow a woman to walk in to get a bone density test without a physician's order. So that's very key. So apart from that 15 or 20 minutes in which the patient is sitting in front of his or her physician and the opportunity presents itself, there will be lots of other opportunity for the patient to instigate the test. Then the test result go to the physician, and then the responsibility, again, is in the physician's hands to recommend appropriate approaches. So this just opens the door wider.
Thank you.
Eric, I'd like to follow up on this. I don't see where the bill does that. You mean right now a woman can't ask for a test because the insurance company won't pay for it unless it's been ordered by a doctor or for other reasons?
No, the test can't be done without a physician's order.
And where does the bill change that?
So here under number 2B, section 2, number 2B.
Yeah, but that's 2 says a health benefit plan shall provide coverage for bone mass as follows. I mean, it's about coverage. It's not about the ability to get the test.
Doesn't the law say both things, though? Without referral from the individual's health care provider. So what you're saying is that it only is talking about coverage, not actually access to the test.
That's right.
So the bill would have to be written in a different way.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not sure what would have to be, I'm not sure what the barrier is now to getting, I mean, I know why you can't get an appendectomy without a prescription, and I know why you can't get a prescription drug without a prescription, but I'm not sure what's stopping, if there's a law that's stopping. Yes, or if it's just custom.
Yeah, I know one part of this relates to radiation safety. So there is an element of Oregon law that says no radiation can be, except mammography, can be utilized for diagnostic purposes without a physician's order. So the hope is, at least my hope is, that this would get around that. And maybe the bill needs to be written in a little different way for that.
Yeah, and my guess is that we need this because health benefit plans, I think, are covering. And that's what I was asking. I believe, you know, I was involved in some of the early research on this way back when. I think the benefit plans cover it, but probably not without a doctor's prescription. So that's what 2B is about. They don't cover it on a self-referral. But I think if there's another barrier, we need to find out what that barrier
is. Yeah, that's a good point.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, welcome back, Representative Minnis.
Thank you.
We missed you.
How did you have? Could you tell me and give me a for instance? What would a woman do, or a person? It's not just women; it's men as well. Would they just one day decide? I mean, what would spur them into wanting to go have this done? And wouldn't it be the natural course to consult with a physician before you have something like this done? What kind of? Give me an example.
So a woman picks up Oprah magazine and reads an article about osteoporosis and realizes that she's 67 years old and has never had a bone density test. She could lift the phone and call a bone density testing lab and get the test done, have those results sent to her physician, have those results herself, and then take the be empowered to go to her physician to ask for what she should then do. So again, it simply, as is true for mammograms now, allows her to put a lot of extra energy into the process of getting care for bone health.
Okay. Does that
make sense? Or?
Mr. Chair, several questions. First off, Medicare covers it, and I don't know how often Medicare allows you to get the test.
I believe this is the way it works now. If you're on a therapy for osteoporosis, Medicare will reimburse at 2-year intervals.
And they will permit the initial test.
And they will do the initial test for women 65 or older, postmenopausal women who have risk factors, and men who have risk factors.
Okay, and I'm not quite sure how we in Oregon can impact how Medicare rules are implemented as far as, because I don't, unless we ask for a CMS waiver, I don't think that we would be able to change that.
So, I don't know the, I don't think we could, go ahead.
Oh, okay, no, I don't think we could do that.
I don't think we can change Medicare, but we can change it for under 65.
Which, in fact, that's the highest risk. I mean, the older you get, the higher your risk, and so that's one issue, and the other issue was so the woman goes and gets the bone density test, and then the technician that does the test doesn't say, well, here you go. They're going to say, well, where do you want this sent, information mm-hmm. sent, because it has to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Without an appropriate, in fact, I don't believe many physicians probably interpret them correctly,
mm-hmm.
but so it's sent back, so then they still have to go to their physician, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're still going to have to pay for an office visit in order to see the results of the test.
True.
Okay.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Representative Tomei, I think our idea is to make it similar, as the doctor was saying, to a mammogram, that then the report goes to your physician, and then your physician would send you a card whether or not you need to see him or her again, or if things are fine.
Because, if I may, under current practice, if a physician provider does not request the test, and a test comes out of the blue, they don't necessarily respond to that report unless it's super, super critical. Mammogram is an excellent example where you do respond. I mean, red flags fly up everywhere when there's a big problem. But in a bone density test, I'm not sure if that necessarily would happen, especially if they have no clue where this referral came from.
Well, I think maybe you've encapsulated part of the problem, that many physicians don't pay attention to this, even when it's put in front of them. And what I think is really necessary is for the interest and energy of the patient, him or herself, to prompt more attention than it is currently getting. I think that's what this bill is all about, is to support the patient's empowerment of his or her interest in preventing osteoporotic fractures. Because clearly what's happening is that the healthcare profession is not taking care of the job. So again, a very safe, relatively inexpensive test that can make a lot of difference with the disease is not being appropriately utilized.
In a very common disease.
Very common disease. And I'm not placing blame on busy physicians. There's lots of other examples of research that has not been translated into practice. But this is a particularly unique example in which we could make a big difference in a safe and cost-effective way.
We blame physicians a lot for a lot of things, don't we?
Well, we try not to. But we do point out their deficiencies.
Okay.
So I would, to follow up on your example, if a bone density result ended up in a physician's office, I would hope that part of the empowerment given to the patient would be to make sure that the physician responded to the results.
Yeah. Representative Maurer raised an interesting issue. You talk about the $85 charge. Is there a charge for interpreting it as well, or does it just, is the report intelligible to the average primary care doctor?
It's intelligible to the average informed primary care doctor, but these are routinely interpreted for $10 or $15. So the lab that this goes
nothing
to...
Nothing interpreted for $10 or $15.
Yes. That's the reimbursed amount.
If I may, just a little
bit. You may
bit.
Continue as long as...
I won't.
As we have Dr. Orwell here.
Okay. So we know that there are a number of different types of bone density tests, and how is now we're asking the patient to become informed on what is the appropriate test, and some of them aren't as accurate. And if you take, you do a heel test 1 year and a spine test the next year, and you go, well, that's, I can't compare them, because you can't compare them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's, I mean, this is a huge educational piece that has to tail with this effort. I don't know. We talk about universal health care, and this is a very market consumeristic approach, which I frankly favor. But it seems like you're kind of pulling in two different directions.
Yeah. So the details are important here. So for the first test, in other words, 67-year-old woman has never had a bone density test, their predictive value of any one of the methodologies is approximately the same in identifying people at risk of fracture. So that first test, there will be great value regardless of the technology used. Dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, the DXA that I refer to, is kind of the gold standard. And if there was an educational effort, and I think there should be, if in fact this became law, it would probably entail some education about which of the technologies was thought to be the most useful. Secondly, the fact that there would need to be an educational element of this doesn't bother me at all, and that would be great. So if we could inform the public about these things, that would be a huge plus, and I think the bill would stimulate that kind of educational effort.
Could you just clarify something for me? You talked about a scan, and you let, is it across the body, or is it the heel?
So the representative brings out the fact that there are three major kinds of bone density testing, the gold standard and the routine. standard and the routine is dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, which measures the spine and the hip. Can measure a variety of places, but essentially the spine and the hip, that's when you lie in a machine and it scans back and forth across you. And the spine and the hip are particularly important because those are the sites of the most important osteoporotic fractures. There are other technologies that measure bone density in the heel. So you frequently see those in drugstores or health fairs. Don't use X-ray, they use ultrasound. And there are some other technologies that can measure bone density in the finger or in the bottom part of the arm that are X-ray based. They're quite uncommon, but they're out there and they're approved. So there are a number of technologies. Again, they all provide useful information about your bone density and your risk of fracture. The reason that dual energy X-ray absorptiometry is the gold standard is not only because it measures the hip and the spine, which are important sites, particularly the hip, but also all of our information concerning the effectiveness of drug therapies is developed with dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. So if you start a drug and you go back 2 years later to see if the drug is having the desired effect on bone density, you need to do that with dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. So the baseline is better if you want to set the stage for follow-up after therapy has begun.
So the patient, follow-up, Mr. Chair, so the patient could request any one of three if they knew they even existed, but they could say, I want the gold standard versus the heel treatment. But first they'd have to know they existed. So under this bill, they could go in and do any one of those three things.
That's right. In fact, now they can go and get the heel test at a variety of places and pay their $35 or whatever it is, because it doesn't use radiation and there's no barrier to getting that test. It's not reimbursed. There's no barrier for it because it's not radiation. So it's just not as good a test.
Okay, thank you.
Question about?
Go for it.
in anticipating something where an uninformed population could ask for radiation-based testing, I mean, would this be appropriate if a woman was undergoing radiation treatment for breast cancer or some other cancer? I mean, would there ever be a time that you can see that a woman may be endangering herself because she's undergoing radiation when she may be undergoing radiation for something else, and her physician knows about the treatment that she is having prescribed but doesn't know that she's decided that she needs a bone marrow or mass check because she watched Oprah?
Yeah. The amount of radiation is so minuscule, again, the same as you'd get in a cross-country plane flight, that it's thought to impart no additional risk. The only time that we don't do bone density testing is in pregnancy. And that's not because there have been any adverse effects or any adverse effects are predicted, but simply because we don't want to expose a fetus to any additional x-ray. But other than that, it's thought to be a totally safe test. So even if someone was receiving x-ray therapy for another reason, it would not preclude them from getting a bone density test. And in fact, that's one of the cancer and chemotherapy and other therapies for cancer are one of the indications for bone density testing.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Orwell, thank you very much. I hope you clarified things for us. I think you did.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I don't get to see him very often anymore. Good. I would like to hear somewhere from the insurance industry before we're done about the extent to which bone densitometry is covered now. So if there would be some way to get that would be very useful. I'll call Marcia Kelly, please, and Betty House. We've got the sign-up sheet here, so if there's anybody else who wants to testify, please let the assistant know.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I come to you today as a public policy committee member for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. AUW is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year, having been advocating for issues regarding women, families, and the good of all for almost all of those 125 years. I think we started advocating for sewer systems in large cities on the East Coast in the 1880s.
Good job. I haven't replaced them since then.
And that may be some of the problems. I know in our neighborhood they replaced them in the 90s. We had woodlands until the 90s. We supported a bill similar to this last year, and we're supporting this bill because we think osteoporosis is an important issue, and the incidence of osteoporosis in our aging population is only going to increase. One of the concerns that we do have, however, is the emphasis on the age, and especially the emphasis on the age of the males in this bill. Strange thing for a women's organization advocating for women. But men after 50 also lose some bone density, and the incidence of hip fractures is 30% in the male population, and hip fractures in the male population are almost twice as the average of 1 year mortality in men who have hip fractures is almost twice as much as women. And mortality in men is also higher than women for vertebral fractures. And we're concerned that if we keep the age at 75 or only do an educational piece at the age of 75 for men, that we might not be catching all of those men who could have osteoporosis or low bone density, and could be adding to both the cost of medical treatment as well as loss of quality of life and loss of companionship for their spouses. So we would, if you're entertaining amendments, have you take a look at that, because we think that that's way too low. There hasn't been nearly as much research done on men and osteoporosis, although there is a the American Medical Association had a option for physicians to sort of do some of their own study, and that was released in December of 2004, and they do suggest that men start losing bone density at the age of 50 for varying reasons, and some things are risk factors, but we do think that talking about 75 for men may be just a little bit too late to start checking for that. And I'd entertain any questions. Thank you.
As soon as this testimony is over, since Dr. Orwell is the one that's doing the study on men, we'll ask him to comment on that. Yes. Please.
Good afternoon. First, I have to apologize because on the first part, I have Chair Tomei. See where my head was. Okay. Since I want to correct that.
Sometimes it's hard to tell us apart.
Oh, I know. It is. And if I didn't see so much of you on Monday and Wednesday nights, I probably would never approve. Oh, my. First, I'd like to start by saying that I'm Betty McChesney House, and I'm representing Delta Kappa Gamma Alpha Rho State as their legislative chair. And Delta Kappa Gamma is an international honorary sorority of educators that have demonstrated excellence in their profession. And I am speaking in favor of House Bill 2953, and one of your people is a member of our organization. And I'd like to pause here for a moment and go and give you a couple of examples that I think will clear up some of the questions that you have. First of all, when you go in to have any x-rays or anything done, the first thing they hand you is a sheet of paper, and they ask for your history. And on that, you'll put down if you were on head cancer and were getting chemo or x-ray therapy of any kind. That's always one of the questions, and what are your illnesses and any other diseases. The second thing is a personal story. I'm 68 years old. I had uterine and ovarian cancer at the age of 35 and was very fortunate to still be here. I have to this day never had a bone density test. And when I mentioned it to my doctor, he says, "You look fine to me." So that is one of the reasons that I am very interested in this bill. The second reason is my husband, who is 73, only had a bone density test after being on medication for a pulmonary problem and had cracked ribs. And they did the test and found out that he had osteoporosis, and now every Thursday morning loyally takes his medication. So those are two personal examples that why I'm involved with this. I think we state fairly well in here why I became involved and why we started this last time. And that was that Madeline Lapp, who was our president at that point, and Janet Walsh was the vice president, were discussing this at a meeting. And we decided there was a problem because most of us had not had bone density tests, and we were finding out that that was a mistake. I have a lot of stats in here, and on the last attached page, you'll find some that I have taken facts and figures from Kaiser Family Foundation that they said in the United States, 1 out of 2 women over 50 have related fractures due to osteoporosis, and 1 in 4 men also suffer from those fractures. Women with small frames, Asian or white, are the first category of sufferers. Some loss begins in the average person between the ages of 35 to 50. Women age 50 or older that have gone through menopause have bone rate from 1 to 6% per year loss. There are 44 million Americans who have low bone mass. In 1 year, there is a cost of $18 billion spent on fractures due to osteoporosis. There are 300,000 hospitals each year with hip fractures, and 20% die within 1 year, and 20% are in nursing homes. adults. The fear of falling for those over 50 may also cause depression. There are 1.5 million Americans a year that suffer fractures due to weak bones. They occur primarily in the wrist, spine, or hip. A healthy skeletal system with strong bones is essential to overall good health and quality of life. Prevention saves money over the life of our citizens. And I think you can read the rest of the testimony on your own. And I'm open for any other questions.
Any questions in this house?
Mr. Chair, you know, if I can make an observation here, this to me is a classic push and pull between market medicine and government trying to tell people what to do. And in another way, in another context, maybe this bill would be written, physicians will be required to refer their patients to get bone mass as opposed to requiring the insurance company to pay for it.
You could introduce that bill.
I don't know. I think the OMA would probably go on the attack. It's very interesting, and it's provider to provider, because I know in our office when you come in that it's not you look fine. It's, well, we'll set you up.
Yeah.
And
that's a surprising answer.
It is a very surprising answer, and I don't know how the rest of the world operates. But in our office, that's not the way it is.
Well, I think it's interesting because I have 8 different doctors. I have a pulmonologist. I have a cardiologist. I have an endocrinologist, retinologist. I can't remember all of them now. But I am a diabetic also. Yet not one of them have ever recommended that I have a bone density test.
Maybe you should get rid of your ologist and just have a nurse practitioner.
Hey, I'm for it, you know.
You want to declare your conflict of interest for that statement?
Do you realize how nice that would be, how much more money I'd have? I wouldn't have all those copays.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you. And I'm sorry about the mistake.
Oh. Dr. Orwell, do you want to comment on the age factors? I think you need to reintroduce yourself.
So the age 75 in...
Can you reintroduce yourself, please?
Eric Orwell, professor of medicine. Enough. So the age 75 in men is a reflection of the cost-effectiveness calculations for doing screening bone mineral density. It turns out that men are at considerably lower risk than women, not negligible risk by any means, but lower risk than women, and that leads to the cost-benefit benefit analyses suggesting that it is cost-effective to screen men at a later time of life. I firmly believe that, and we maybe should consider altering the bill to reflect the fact that men who have risk factors for osteoporosis deserve bone density testing at any age. It shouldn't be limited to age 75 or above. What are the risk factors? If you've had a previous fracture after the age of 80, if you take medications that are known to be associated with osteoporosis, like glucocorticoids, men who have prostate cancer and are treated with androgen deprivation therapy clearly lose bone and have increased fracture risk. Men who have renal failure, who have hepatic failure, who have rheumatoid arthritis, there's a long list of risk factors known to be associated with low bone density and increased fracture risk. Any of those risk factors should apply equally to men and women.
Thank you. Eric, thank you very much for coming down today. I think we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2953 and see if we can get a little more information to deal with both the questions of what the blocks are and what we can do that doesn't relate to Medicare, because a lot of people can do with Medicare, and see where we're going. Perhaps you and I can work directly on this. Perhaps I have some angle. We'll see how we do. Thank you for bringing it. Why don't we join? We have three public hearings we want to do. It looks like two of them are very similar. Two of them are about Venturis. And why don't we bring those open, a public hearing on 3095 and 3096 together? Does that make sense?
Ours, 3094 is ours too.
Well, I'd be happy to open all three of them, 3094 as well.
What do you
like
to do, sir?
It would be useful if you could. Fill us in on those. Marjorie, you want to comment on them a bit before we turn the proponents loose?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your staff measure summaries are right there available to you.
Okay.
If you'd like to peruse those before Jim takes over.
Thank you. I'm sure Jim can give us more information than we can cope with.
Absolutely.
You want all three of you together? Show.
That's pretty good.
Your name has to start with a J to be in this panel.
Welcome. Which would you like me to begin with, sir?
Your pleasure, Jim.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and just go down by number? I'm Jim Davis, and I'm representing the Oregon State Insurance Association, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Gray Panthers, United Seniors. We urge, we'll start with, if we may, with 3094. And we have some of our compatriots here to talk about those as well. We want to urge you to support 3094, which expands the definition of a provider within the insurance code to allow for dental professionals to be specifically included in the laws where it requires insurance providers to promptly pay claims filed on behalf of policyholders. Currently, there is some difficulty amongst, I know, amongst our denturists, and certainly I'm sure that dentists have difficulties and other dental health professionals as well in terms of getting prompt payments back on dental-related claims. It sometimes takes large amounts of time for them to get payments. Sometimes there's other difficulties that they run into. So we feel that guarantees for prompt payment in the law should extend to dental health professionals as well as medical and mental health professionals. And just very quickly, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague Joe Koss on this one, we have submitted a hand and gross amendment. It was very simple. We just wanted to add two words. If hopefully there is movement, and we'd like to just make that simple change. And as you can see on page two, it's just a very simple change from the earlier definition, medical
just
or mental health services. Excuse me.
Hold on a minute. We're trying to see if we don't have those amendments.
No, you don't.
Oh, okay.
We just over the weekend came up with this, so you wouldn't have them, and our apologies for not getting them to you this morning.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So,
somewhere, you want to tell us what they are?
On page two, as you can see, it's just a very simple change in the definition of provider. Right? It says provider means a person licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized or permitted by laws of the state to administer. And then what we would take out is medical or mental health services and add medical and dental services that address physical, oral, or mental health care needs in the ordinary course of business or practice of a profession. So essentially, we would just be adding dental and oral health to the definition here within these prompt payment laws.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Joseph. Chair Greenlick, representatives of the committee. I'm Joe Koss, and I'm here today with from two perspectives of expertise and interest in this particular and the other bills as well. I serve as an administrative support staff to the Oregon Denturist Association and have done so for about 11 years. And I also serve as a board member on the Board of Denture Technology, where I have been for 9 years, and I was the chair for 6. Speaking specifically to 3094, other than to just echo the things that that Jim was saying, the issue around these reimbursement requirements, it's simply a matter of expanding the scope of coverage of insurance code to include oral health care professionals as well as medical and mental health care professionals. It doesn't restrict the scope that already exists. It just expands it a bit. And what it does do is it adds oral health care professionals to the list of those that are obligated to be paid in a prompt manner, which is normally within 30 days of when a clean claim is submitted. And if the insurance company chooses not to respond in a prompt manner and the claim is clean, then there is a penalty to be paid to the practitioner that is submitting that claim. In the past, we have had experiences where practitioners have submitted clean claims, and since there is no obligation on the part of an insurance provider to respond promptly, they tend to pocket the claim request, you know, stating, well, we never got it, they don't respond at all, and upon resubmission of the claim, they say we never got it, and there's just a number of reasons why they would choose not to honor it promptly. And this just puts the onus on them to treat oral health care professionals the same way that they treat medical and mental health care professionals.
Thank you. I don't see any opposition to 94. So why don't you go to 95?
Mr. Chair, I do have a quick question.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
It's about,
excuse me.
I'm sorry. This is about your billing practices, and do Joe's dental services bill on paper, or are we now electronically?
Representative Maurer, Chair Greenlake, I think that the reimbursement process can be handled in two ways. It can either be handled via a paper reimbursement request.
My question was, are most of them paper, or are most of them electronic, or do we have any?
I think maybe Joe here can also answer that question.
Okay.
You need to introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Joe Hammer. I'm a licensed denturist in Kaiser and also sit on the board of Denture Technology. As far as the claims, majority of them, I believe, are paper. Okay, the electronic filing is being done by some, but not all. And I'm sure in time it'll be more. But routinely, we will turn in our claims, and it can be a month, 2 months, 3 months before we get any response, whether it's a yes or a no or a payment. I've gone out as far as a year and a half trying to collect on claims that have been turned in. Sometimes it will be that the 6 places on the form that require a date, one of them was missed, and they will send it back for that reason. Other times, sometimes there's no reason that they deny the claim. Sometimes they just will tell us that they never received it, even though we have a paper copy of it. But it is routinely a problem, and I think we it's something that needs to be looked into, because we are not providing the services to our patients as we could if we weren't waiting so long for payment on things. And many of them require them to maybe have to pay out of their pocket because their claims are being denied by their insurance companies, even though they are covered by their insurance, but they don't want to pay the claims.
Any other questions? Are you done with your testimony, Mr. Hammer? I'm sorry.
Do you have anything else to add on that,
though? No.
Okay. Let's close the public hearing on 3094. Move on to 3095.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Dentist Association, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Gray Panthers of Oregon, and United Seniors of Oregon. We want to urge the committee to support House Bill 3095, which we hope will resolve inconsistencies within the dental and denturist statute around the ability of a denturist to own and operate a dental clinic with the services of a licensed denturist. We've actually talked to legislative council and are not certain whether there have amendments been forwarded in any way, but when the bill came back from legislative council, our intent had been that we would be exempted out of this aspect of the Dental Practice Act that I will explain in a minute, not as it appears to be exempted out of the whole Dental Practice Act. We just wanted out of this one aspect around clinics, and so as you can see in the hand gross copy, we just want it moved up under the exemptions and not made a total exemption, because that was in no way our intent. Anyway, in contrast, we have in denturist statute language that conflicts with language in the Dental Practice Act around the restriction of clinic ownership for denturists. There are certain exceptions in the Dental Practice Act, and it was Senate Bill 390, which required that dentists have dental clinics, and they had certain exemptions in there, and we are simply going to want to add ourselves in as an exemption to that. The reason being is that we want to align with our own denturist laws, which allows for denturists and dentists to establish mutually beneficial business relationships to provide dental services to Oregonians. If you measure... if you remember, Measure 24 was passed in the 2002 election, and that was the latest denturist initiative, and its main thrust was around partial dentures. But what it also did was establish a statement at the end of the denturist statutes that said a dentist as defined in ORS 679.010 and a denturist may cooperate and maintain any business or professional association that is mutually agreeable with each being responsible for their respective areas of expertise. The intent and the specific purpose of that statutory language was to allow denturists and dentists to be able to form these mutually agreeable business relationships, and for a denturist to be able to have a dental clinic where they would not own the dental practice of the individual, but where they would cooperate, they would work together, and they would have the opportunity where the denturist would own the building, the equipment, and the business. And so it was very clear in our language. And so what we're feeling is that denturists and dentists should have the ability to establish strong collaborative relationships and remove unnecessary delays and additional expenses and compromises in the delivery of services. And since the two professions are very highly intertwined, it makes sense for there to be more of a seamless kind of environment like this. And it's worked very well in clinics now that are owned by denturists in Oregon, have worked well, as they have in Washington State. And they've been proven very mutually beneficial and work very, very well together on for the best for the community and for mostly senior consumers, but also lower income consumers. So we would ask that you support this legislation. This legislation we put through on other occasions that would clarify this distinction. And I think that'll be it for now. I can give you more detail as you want.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, again, I'm Jim Koss with the Board of Denture Technology and with the Oregon Denturist Association. And my only comments I'd like to make with regards to 3095 might be a little bit more on the historical side, and I'll relate specifically to the issues around the definitions of practice and clinic. I was around when the original language was added to Dental Practices Act around the ownership of a dental clinic, and the issues, as I recall, were sparked by a case where a dentist had passed away, and where the dentist at that point didn't have control of their own practice, and so at that time the family had no legacy, if you will, with which it could, you know, was built upon the husband for any kind of financial security for the family, and all they had was the physical plant, the chairs and the, you know, the other equipment. And the discussion went around the fact that that's not the right thing to do, and the comments that I recall were around the issue of dental practices should be owned. In this case, they said dental clinics should be owned by dentists. They shouldn't be owned by entrepreneurial entities. And so with that kind of a discussion, we attempted to have conversations around the definitions of clinic and practice, and those discussions never went on at a point where we could actually have any amendments done to the original bill. So the original bill was passed out the way that it said, that a dentist is the only one who can own a dental clinic. And at that point, ballot measure 24 was passed, and it came to
pass before that.
The ballot measure 24, when it passed, had language in it that was a little bit more broad with regards to the clinic being a mutually beneficial business relationship. And I think that this modification that we are recommending and suggesting is to help bring about that clarification, as Jim mentioned, that a practice is patient records. A practice is the relationship between the practitioner and the patient, and it is something that belongs to the practitioner in terms of, you know, their control of that element of healthcare. The clinic, however, is a physical plant. It is chairs. It is all of the support materials and services that might go into providing for that practice. Denturists don't want to own dental practices. The liability is too great. It's not within their scope of practice, and that's not the intent of any of this. And so what we're talking about here moves another step in the direction of clearly differentiating between a clinic and a practice. And I think that's an important element to be considered within this bill.
Mr. Hammer, do you have anything?
Yes, Chairperson. I'd just like to say that what...
Introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm sorry. My name is Joe Hammer, licensed insurist in Kaiser. This bill, or the changes to this, it allows not for a denturist to practice anything that we're not licensed to do. It allows the opportunity for young dentists coming out of dental school to be able to go into a clinic where they, coming out of school, could not afford to be working and open their own business. It allows them to gain maybe some experience from an older denturist that's had opportunity to work in dentures and partials where they are not being trained in dental school right now to do those sort of things. But the scope of their practice can mesh really well with us in our business, and just allow opportunity for them to get a start, and to also just to get better care to the patients, so they're not having to go here and to go there. They can come to a clinic that possibly is owned by a denturist and yet still practice there and do their thing, have their own patients, have their own records, but in no way are being controlled by the denturist there. Thank you.
Are there any questions in this panel?
If I might, Mr. Chair, I did want to relay that we have had some dealings with the Department of Justice around this issue. They have challenged some of our denturists for their ownership of clinics in two cases in Southern Oregon. In each case, agreements have been worked out in terms of contractual arrangements with the dentist. So it's very clear, spelled out clearly. They're not necessarily an employee of the clinic, but there's a contractual arrangement that allows them to work together. So it appears we're coming to some agreement on how this can all be worked out, but we still would like to have that exemption.
Representative Cannon?
Mr. Chair, thank you. It would be very helpful for me to hear, perhaps from another witness or from someone else on the committee, what the rationale is for requiring clinics to be owned by dentists. And I just, from a standpoint of not having seen this or known this about our law, I'd be interested in knowing.
My recommendation is you don't go there.
We had a debate last session, and I couldn't quite figure out what the debate was, even when we had a full-blown debate.
Well, this bill is proposing to open up that ownership a little farther than it is now, so it seems fundamental.
Somebody here want to take a run at that? Dennis, you were here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't want to say it's about turf, because that might be not totally correct.
Right.
But I believe that the crux of it was focused around who should have control over the records and the practice when it's something as unique and complex as dental work, and it should be a dentist that does that. I think the analogy is drawn to a law practice that lawyers can own law practices, but not non-lawyers. In this instance, the discussion kind of changes from the practice itself, which would assume to be the files and that kind of thing, and the clinic where the practice could be housed. And so I really am not prepared.
Yeah. We've got a witness from the Board of Dentistry who's going to be speaking, I think, in opposition.
Yes.
To this. Perhaps we could ask him that question.
Sure.
If you would maybe vacate a chair or vacate all three chairs before you come back for the next one. And
sure, no problem.
We'll ask Mr. Bratz to join the discussion. Maybe you can help Representative Ken in his background to this discussion.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. You have my written testimony there, and actually it differs a little bit because Patrick Bratz, I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. Actually, the bill as presented and the three gentlemen prior are very clear. The bill as written would exempt dentures from the Practice Act, and that was the major concern that the board had, is the fact that it was not part of subsection 3. It simply exempted them in totality. To answer your question, what's going on right now is currently denturists and denturist practices can have dentists working in their dental offices. They can own the building. They can own the equipment. They can own the receipts. What they can't own is the patient records, and they can't have control of the patient care. And that's basically, to Representative Cannon, that's the basic definition. And I think, as Representative Richardson said, I can't own a law office because I'm not a lawyer. There are some specific exemptions of who can own dental practices, which the legislature did in, I think, 2003 session. Places like Willamette and Northwest Medical Teams, they have specific provisions, and it's an issue. We have had at least two or three complaints that the board has dealt with that were mentioned to you. Because they were non-licensed complaints, I can talk a little bit more about them than I could if they were licensees. And this was an issue where these particular practices were controlling the patient records and were controlling the actual care and quality. And we have seen agreements that have now been signed. Matter of fact, I just had one faxed to me today where the dentist has entered in as an independent contractor, making it very clear that he or she controls the patient care, he or she controls the patient records. From our standpoint, that's very important, because when the patient feels that they've been harmed and they want to file a complaint, the Board of Dentistry has no jurisdiction over the denturist. The Board of Dentistry only has jurisdiction over that dentist. And one of the key parts of our case is we need to have those records. We need to analyze those records and see what the treatment was and what the care was provided. If the dentist doesn't control those records, we can't get them. We can't make them come from someone that doesn't have any authority under us.
And did I hear you say, I don't know whether that's answered your question, but did I hear you say that you will not be in opposition to the bill were it amended the way it's being proposed?
Well, I can't say that because I haven't had a chance to discuss that. The original bill as it came out, we were definitely in opposition because it was total exemption.
So you will get us back an answer?
We'll get you back an answer, yeah.
Mr. Chair, is it your, thank you, is it your understanding, your interpretation that the organizations listed under subsection 3 have access to patient records? These are not dentists, but they're institutions such as School of Dentistry at OHSU, nonprofit corporations, and now we're proposing denturists. Do they, those that are currently in, listed in subsection 3, do they have access to patient records? Which seems to be the point of contention.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Cannon, what happens under existing law, and let me use OHSU for an example, they have a dental clinic. They have named someone as a dental director. So if one of the patients files a complaint against one of the dentists that worked on the particular patient, we will contact that dentist and the dental director and require that they answer questions regarding that issue. Because the law requires there be a dental director named to be in charge of the dental operation of that particular clinic. And so under existing law, the same thing with a corporation, let's say, for example, and I'll use Willamette as an example. They have a major dental practice in this state, and they name someone to be a dental director, even though they may be a corporate structure. Therefore, if there's an issue, the Board of Dentistry has a way to handle that issue. We can't go after the corporate stockholders or go after, let's say, a particular man or woman that owns the corporation if they're not a dentist. We have no power or control over them. So under existing law, those exemptions that you see, we do have that. And that was a provision that was put in 2003 to allow that to happen. And that's the biggest issue that we're coming from is the public protection issue. It may sound good in regarding to access issues, but sometimes things go wrong and people do file complaints, and we have to be able to.
In answer to Representative Cannon's question, they do own the practice, the other exemptions.
They do own the practice, that's correct.
And this exemption would not be to own the practice.
This exemption, as I understand it, would allow them to own a practice, but again, they'd have to fulfill the requirements. They'd have to name a dental director. The dental director would have to adhere to all of these standards. Again, the person that owns the practice cannot be involved in the day-to-day operation of dental care. But again, most of these entities are rather large entities where you're talking about having 50, 60, 200 dentists. You may be talking about an operation where the dental director is also the dentist. He himself or she in that particular operation. And again, I don't know that because we didn't have a chance to look at the bill in that regard.
We need to push this because I think the testimony is they don't want to own the practice. Right. They just want to own the clinic.
And as I say, Chair Green, they can do that right now. They can own the building. They can own the physical plant. They can own all the equipment. They can lease it back. The only thing they cannot have, and it's very clearly spelled out in the law, they cannot do care to make decisions on the daily care to care of the patients, and they cannot own the patient records. Those are the dentists. Because as a dentist leaves, he or she is supposed to transfer those records to another qualified dentist.
Well, if I heard their testimony correctly, they don't want to own a practice. They want to own a building. And if I hear your testimony correctly, they can already do that in an unambiguous way.
That's correct.
So we do need to think about how this comes together. But I think your question really led us in exactly the right place. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Is this about this is a liability issue?
From the board standpoint, it's not a liability issue. It's a public protection issue. From some other people, it might be a liability issue as to who's liable if you want to get into malpractice and other such things. From the board standpoint, it's a public protection. When we have a complaint, in order for us to deal with that complaint, we have to have patient records, we have to be able to interview the dentists, people involved, et cetera. And we only have control over dentists and dental hygienists. We don't have control over other people that may own, quote, the operation.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 3095. And if we could have some very brief testimony. Jim, if you would do it on 3096. We're running out of time.
Okay, no problem. Can I have my board members up here, too, just
sure,
to ask a question?
Quick, okay. We've got a work session we need to do yet today.
But we'll make it quick. We'll make it quick. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing Oregon State Denturist Association, State Council for Retired Citizens, Great Panthers, and United Seniors, and we come before you to ask for your support of 3096. In this bill,
We're making some changes and clarifications in the language of the Oregon State Dentures statutes. Most of the proposed changes don't really make monumental changes in what dentures are doing. It's really there to clarify. For instance, in one section, you can see that there was a language put in around official transcripts verifying completion rather than the vague language that had been there before around just satisfactory evidence. This just clarifies and simplifies that. It also clarifies and simplifies the language around supervised clinical practice, and I'm going to have my friends here talk to you in more detail about that. Also, what the bill does is expand some reciprocity requirements. It puts in that practicing denturists from the District of Columbia, and we don't even know that there is one at this point, and practicing denturists from Canada would be able to apply for licensure and gain licensure if they had educational and licensing requirements that were substantially equivalent to those that are outlined in our law. Essentially, they have to have received the same education, the same kind of licensure. And in Canada, as it turns out, they are the best trained, the best educated denturists in the world. They have wonderful universities that train their denturists, and it is the kind of the bastion of denturism for the world stage. So if any of those denturists came down, it would almost be a certainty that they would have equivalent training, and we'd want to open up opportunities here in Oregon. And the reason we want to do that is that with the senior population growing by leaps and bounds, as well as the lower income and the disability populations, there's much, much greater need for dentures and for denturists, but yet the number of denturists have remained pretty static. And so we're a little concerned about that, and we're trying to reach out to people to get involved in denturism, and we're also trying to say that if a qualified person wants to come into the state, they would have the opportunity to do so. So these changes, as recommended, came as over months of deliberations by the Board of Denture Technology, who oversees the profession, and the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, as well as the State Denturist Association, and then came to these conclusions that ultimately became this bill.
And they're not in opposition to this?
No, everybody, all those above named are very supportive. Yeah. Absolutely.
Representative Greenlake and Chair of our committee, I'm Joe Koss again, and I'm just going to speak today based on my experiences on the Board of Denture Technology, where we, in fact, worked on the language that you see in 3096. We did, in fact, spend quite a bit of time laboring over our rules, our statutes, and denturist regulations to find out where it is that we could come into harmony, if you will, with the Health Licensing Agency's mandate to streamline activities and regulations. As you probably know, there has been effort on the part of the Health Licensing Agency to create one set of standardized rules that apply to all bodies that are under their jurisdiction, and then each board goes about the process of creating rule that applies specifically to them. And while we were doing that process, we began to look at what was left after we split the two, and we saw there was some inconsistencies and ambiguities in the language. There was one phrase, the general supervision phrase, which had no definition in our rule, so we had to take that out because it made no sense. And we got great help and great counsel from the Health Licensing Agency's experts in writing language, and I'm speaking specifically about Trish Albreton. With regards to, and briefly, I'll just say something about this Canadian issue.
Very briefly.
Yeah, the Canadian issue is one that, even though there's been a standard set now for consideration of non-Oregon licensed denturists to apply for a license to practice in Oregon, and what this would allow is it would allow Canadian denturists to be considered under that same set of criteria as a denturist licensed within the United States. It guarantees them no privilege, no precedence, no streamlining or fast tracking, and
we figured it would take many years before we would be able to go through all the processes required to modify our rules and to go through the verification process before any denturists out of Canada could practice in Oregon. And during that process, we would have plenty of opportunity to hear debate about whether or not it was appropriate the way it was written, or whether we would have to modify the language even further to ensure patient safety. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any questions? If everybody's in agreement from that, that would be helpful to know. I'm going to close the public hearing on 396. Jim and Joe, I would ask you to get together with Mr. Bratz and find out whether there really is a need for 3095 or what that need is. I mean, if they're clear that you can do what you're asking to do now, there's no point in having a bill.
Well, hopefully not. That would be great.
Maybe we can exchange letters or something. Yeah. That would be great.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to open a work session on HB 2517. We have some amendments on it. That's the dash two amendments. And I hear everybody's in agreement with those, including the health insurers. Can somebody give me some information about that? John, are you coming or leaving?
No,
exactly. You're not escaping, huh? Well, who wants to start? Whoever.
Mr. Chair and members of committee, Matthew Bradley, orthopedic resident, OHSU. Thank you for having me back. It's good to see all of you again. Mr. Chair, pre-request, I have sat down with all interested parties who that expressed interest in discussing this, including the two gentlemen sitting next to me. Also contacted were representatives from Kaiser and representatives from Providence and Pacific Care. We have put together these amendments, or this dash two amendments. To the best of my knowledge, this is acceptable by all parties I have spoken to. Nobody has expressed any negativities or any resentment towards any of this, either by email or by a vocalization to myself. So my understanding is the way that it is proposed to you and written up in these dash twos is acceptable by all parties, including the prosthetic and orthotic industry and the various insurance parties that have spoken with me personally.
Okay, Matthew, thank you. Guys?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and I just wanted to echo what Dr. Bradley indicated in regard to the work group that has come together and worked out this compromise. On Regents' behalf, we had our medical director work closely on this as well. And while we remain opposed to mandates generally, if this is a bill that the legislature sees fit to pass, we think this is a workable solution and a workable compromise consistent with Medicare and the current state of medical policy. Thank you.
So you clarify that a little bit. I mean, if the bill passes, this is the form you want it to pass in. Are you neutral on the bill itself, or are you opposed to it because it's a mandate?
We are neutral on the bill, Chair Greenlake.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I let Mike talk because he was involved in all of this negotiations. I do believe everybody has agreed to the Dash 2 amendments as being medically based and based on what would be best for each patient. And again, as I testified earlier, that is Regents' policy currently is to try to get the best device for the particular patient who is in need. And these amendments do that.
Other questions? Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, Dr. Bradley, if you could walk us. It sounds like there was some narrowing of scope here in the Dash 2 amendments, and I wonder if you could walk us through what those are and satisfy us that they will nevertheless satisfy the needs of prosthetic users.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair and Representative Cannon, to take a step back even further, my goal in entering the whole process here was to provide quality prosthetic and orthotic coverage for patients in need. I did not particularly want to stipulate who provided that care or to what degree the care was. I wanted these patients to have reasonable access to that. Unfortunately, this was my first go at legislation, and I think the original proposed legislation was a little vague and unclear, I think, is what was told me. So I sat down with the various insurance agencies, and what we did is we just tightened up all of the definitions such that it defines medically necessary devices. And if you look at, I don't know what version you have, but on mine, the proposed amendments to House Bill 2517, line 10, it defines orthotic device and it defines prosthetic device. And it goes further on to say that it is necessary as means to regain your activities of daily living and your necessary work requirements. Basically, to try and get you back to the level of performance you were prior to this injury. What we did not want to do is we did not want to open this up and allow these devices to go above and beyond what you were or to be used for preventative kind of stuff. If you want to go up skiing on Mount Hood and be dropped off by a helicopter and go off a 50-foot cliff, that's your own thing. I have no problem with that. But you're not going to get a C collar and a back brace and leg braces and foot braces and all that to hopefully prevent an injury. And that's what I think the original bill would have allowed for that we've kind of gone back through. So the first step we did was we identified definitions of what are these devices. The next thing we tried to do is to identify which devices could and could not be covered even a little bit further. What we didn't want to do is we didn't want to open this up to devices that did not have proper testing and documentation, the research. I didn't want any experimental. I didn't want anybody coming up with some experimental device and saying, we're going to put this on and have the insurance companies be required to pay for this. So that's what was a little bit tricky for us to kind of work out the language for that, and that's what that line 15 or that section 3 where the director of the Department of Consumer Affairs will adopt rules identifying these. What Medicare does every year is it assigns all the different devices codes. And those codes not only go through their standards, but these guys can explain it. There's, seven other agencies that kind of define what are and are not tested and proven devices. And so what we've assigned is the director to go through the list and every year and to say what is and what is not approved so that we eliminate any kind of experimental or unproven type devices. That was kind of put in there to even eliminate it further, to redefine our definitions even further. The final section, I did not want to, when I started this whole process, I didn't want to rewrite the entire book. I didn't want to change the way insurance is done and coverage is done. I didn't want to redefine the way physicians worked and the way the prosthetic industry worked. And so I sat down with all parties and I kind of figured out how the system works, how we go from the physician writing a prescription to the prosthetist making the device to the device being provided and the insurance ultimately paying for it or not paying for it and what the process was if there was a rejection there. And it became very clear to me that there was a very good system set up for defining medical necessity and that if there was some kind of disagreement there, there are external systems in place with non-biased parties to hear each case individually. That became very clear to me that was all established. So my original bill had this kind of any willing provider, which basically the patient could go to anybody that provides these services. And I quickly realized that that's very inconsistent with a lot of insurance plans today with the preferred care providers or these closed networks and stuff. And it became clear to me why these existed. So in talking to them, we thought it would be best to leave a choice for each patient, to not have one person that they could go to. But I think a choice of two is certainly something I, as a patient, as a physician, like to see, but it's also something I think that could that the insurance companies could maintain within their preferred care providers. I don't think anywhere in the state we couldn't come up with two quality prosthetists or two quality orthotists to be included within this network to give the patients a little bit of choice. If they're unhappy with one, if they don't feel they're getting the care for one, they do have a choice, but there's not any choice. It's not an open book policy.
Can I ask a little about that? I mean,
yes, sir.
If a managed care program has one neurosurgeon, and that's how they decide people join that managed care program, they get the choice of one neurosurgeon. Why would, say, a managed care program serving Baker City need to provide two orthotic suppliers?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a great question. I just, you know, as a physician myself, I would hope that every one of my patients would have access to a second opinion and to second care if they thought that necessary. I would hope that I'm not the only person that my opinion is the care that they're delegated to have to take or receive no care. You know, your example, the neurosurgeon, you know, you picked a subspecialty that's very rare, and there's not very many people representing neurosurgery, and you're kind of restricted in the areas you go to. I don't think some of the smaller states have neurosurgeons. That'd be a difficulty. I think within the prosthetic and orthotic industries, I think there are plenty enough providers out there that we could come up with two quality providers and give that choice. I don't think that is a particular problem in most subspecialties. It certainly isn't in orthopedics, and I can't believe it would be in prosthetics or orthotics either.
Are there any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank
you, sir. Mr. Barros, you want to join us, or are you happy not to?
I'm happy not to, Mr. Chairman, just to say something with this delegation.
Would you?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Barros representing the association that brought this bill forward along with Dr. Bradley. We are here to say we are in support of the Dash 2 amendments. We think he and the insurance industry have done a masterful job of narrowing this bill down, all of the comments that Representative Cannon made, and we think it's a workable bill and will do the job for people in the state of Oregon that need this service. And we're supported. Thank you.
And it's your impression that most of the insurance industry has no problem with this?
That is my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Barros? Okay. I think what would make sense to do is to have a motion to adopt the Dash 2, which is basically a gut and stuff except for a few lines, and then move it to the full committee. It will give, if there is opposition to it, it sounds like, wrong. If there's opposition, it'll give folks a chance to let us know by Friday. We'll put it on the agenda for Friday, I think, or for the following Friday. So I would accept an amendment on the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair.
I mean a motion. Senator Cannon?
I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2517.
Is there any discussion on that? Any objection? The Dash 2 amendments are accepted to House Bill 2517.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2517 as amended by the Dash 2s to the full Health Care Committee, I guess with a due pass recommendation?
Due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If you're adding with a due pass recommendation, but you're also saying that if there's opposition, they can come.
You can talk about it again.
That's a little different.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to take the opportunity to congratulate Dr. Bradley on what seems like a really incredible effort for a citizen doctor to take on this issue that he cares a lot about, to work with the stakeholders, and probably with some help from Mr. Barros, pull together a group of folks who are able to support this bill. I just think that's the sort of modest model of citizen lawmaking and coming to their legislature and doing good things that they care about. So I just am very, very impressed with that.
He obviously doesn't have enough to do as a resident. Talk to his
Please don't pour that to my boss.
much less his wife.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I just congratulate you on being willing to kind of slow it down a little bit, allow the two sides to get together and work out their differences? I think it's made it a better bill, and congratulations again to you all for your efforts on this issue.
Good, thank you. Eric, can we have a roll call, please?
Aye.
Representative
Nix.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cannon.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson.
Aye.
Chair
Grayman.
Aye.
The motion passes. If you have a volunteer to carry it on to the... I'll carry it.
Great.
And we'll schedule it as soon as we can. And make sure if anybody has any problems, they let us know. Is there any other business to be brought before the group? Those of us who want to join the Senate committee at 5, we'll hear all about how tribes relate to the healthcare system. That should be very exciting. Given that, I close this meeting of the